I'm Baratunde Thurston, coming to you live from Los Angeles, California. Welcome back to the second episode of Unfinished Live, an interactive digital series where we use questions, your questions, to explore what's possible now. Today, we're going to take a step back and a step up and talk about democracy and voice. As I know, you know, we just witnessed and participated in an historic election in the United States, during a pandemic, no less, with record turnout. People came out from all over the country, every race, every place, to decide the leaders who work for us. And I want to offer my sincere round of applause, America. Well done. And I know it hasn't been easy. And I commend you and commend us in the process. We're all feeling a lot. Every feeling possible has been bubbling up this year and in this past week in particular. Many of you may feel joy and relief. Others may feel frustrated, angry, distrustful. There are still a lot of unknowns, like who's going to control the U.S. Senate? Or what are we going to do with all that time we invested into refreshing the websites of our news sites? There's so much we don't know. And the fact remains that we are a deeply divided country with a lot of work to do. And I believe that work has to begin by asking questions, by being in conversation, and by reflecting on how we might heal as a nation. And on the subject of healing, because that's like a trending topic nowadays, everybody's in the healing business. Let me tell you my perspective on healing. There can be no healing without an acknowledgement of harm, without an acknowledgement of hurt, without an acknowledgement of pain and injury. And if we can start to see that shared pain in each other, we can start the process of healing. What's key is that we're having this conversation together. So connect alongside me in the chat, reflect with me, say hi, and tell me what's your state. Literally, what state are you in geographically and emotionally? How are you feeling and where are you feeling it from? And I want to give a shout out because I like to pick a person or a place that resonates with me. So to the Brick Bottom Arts Building in Somerville, Massachusetts. Hello, Jill. I see you. I used to live over in the Ville. Nobody calls it that. But I used to live over in Somerville, and it's good to see a familiar place showing up in these streams. Just like we're in conversation now, we went around a few days ago asking people on the street for their views. What's finished or unfinished in our democracy right now? After that, we'll hear from two contemplative voices. You know, the kind of voices many of us need right about now, no matter your political persuasion. Arthur Brooks is a Harvard professor. Don't hold that against him. He's the former president of the American Enterprise Institute, a conservative think tank. And he's an author who writes about living our best lives. Krista Tippett is an award-winning journalist and host of the On Being radio program and podcast, a show that asks, what does it mean to be human and how do we want to live? Arthur and Krista may not share politics, but they do share a deep commitment to reimagining our civic life. We've invited them to have a conversation and ask each other the questions you and unfinished audience members have pondered about democracy and voice, including questions you submitted during the last episode. So when we ask you to submit questions, you might be in the next show. Right now, listen in.
I believe that patriotism is unfinished, but I believe it's in a tough place right now. It's hard to be patriotic whenever the country that you're supposed to be patriotic for is in such disarray.
Because if you don't have patriotism, you don't have people that are willing to go on the front lines and die for our democracy and who we are.
Patriotism. Finished. I think there's a lot of people that are overly prideful in America. Not to say America's bad, but there's definitely some points to not be so patriotic about.
It's used to separate people instead of bringing them together.
Patriotism is unfinished, but not in the extreme case, right? So not in the sense of you're discriminating against somebody from other country like myself, right? You should be proud of where you come from. Politics at the table, finished.
finished. Yeah, I don't see no reason why you discuss politics table. You're eating with the people, you should just enjoy them.
I think it's unfinished. I mean, especially with the new generation, I have two daughters, and it amazes me even at 14 and 17 how opinionated they are.
Finished and unfinished. We need to educate maybe elders as well in the way that the younger people are feeling about these circumstances, but also, I don't know, it creates tension.
Yeah, politics at the dinner table is unfinished. Like, we're gonna be having uncomfortable Thanksgivings now till the end of time.
Thanksgiving should be interesting this year. Let's just put it that way.
Civility. Civility.
Civility.
Civility. Unfinished. So we definitely need to stay civil as people. You can't just be doing uncivil things.
Because we can't have civility as a people if the person leading our country isn't civil.
I think that there are still good people, and I think that there are a lot of civil people around, and just what happens is people who are uncivil are louder.
I just have to believe that it'll never be finished. And I know a lot of wonderfully civilized people that have a lot of magnificence that has come out and goodness that has come out of this time. And that's what I choose to focus on if I can.
Hello, Arthur.
Hi, Krista. How are you?
What a momentous year. What a momentous month. What a momentous century. One of the many very strange aspects of this time we inhabit is that the word civility and actually the word healing, that these have become controversial. What does civility mean to you? What must civility be now?
You started off, I think, correctly. You said, you know, civility has become controversial. And the reason is because we have this misbegotten idea that the mark of moral courage is showing sufficient outrage toward those with whom we disagree. And that's completely wrong. I mean, it might be a good thing to do. But the truth is that moral courage comes not from standing up to the people with whom you disagree. It comes from standing up to the people with whom you agree on behalf of those with whom you disagree. And that actually, for me, means it's true that civility is controversial, but it's controversial in the other direction. It's not that it's too weak because we should be more outraged. On the contrary, I just think it's too low a standard for, you know, good people, for people that actually want to build a good country and a better world. You know, the truth is, if we want to make any gains, any progress, we need to take the 2,000-year-old transgressive injunction of willing the good of the others, even when we don't agree with them and even when we don't like them, because liking, as Martin Luther King one time said, to like is a sentimental something. We need the iron will of love. Do you agree?
I agree. I think the word civility is equated with niceness and politeness and what is before us and what is alienating us from each other is serious and important, and politeness and niceness and tameness aren't big enough or serious enough to meet that. But that obscures the large question before us, which is, how do we share life? And how do we recreate politics and civil society, which I don't think is a statement that, I don't think a dissatisfaction with politics and civil society as they exist now is a statement or a question that is restricted to any side of our political spectrum. You know, maybe at the extreme ends, but most of us don't want to live this way. And reframing what civility should mean, I mean, for me, civility has got to mean that we accept and assume that there are significant, passionate differences between us.
And you said, you made a point that I really agree with deeply just a second ago, which was that it's important that we hold on to passionate differences while being actually able to be civil to one another, or in, I would prefer to love one another. I mean, that's what the best relationships are able to do. You can actually be hammer and tongs with somebody forever and still love that person and still have a relationship with that person. The idea that we must agree my way or the highway, it's all or nothing, that way of thinking is actually destroying our society. And by the way, as a social scientist, I can tell you, it destroys marriages, it destroys friendships. This is the reason that 1 in 6 Americans have stopped talking to a family member or friend, going back to the 2016 election and getting worse through the 2020 election. We can do a lot better, but it actually, it sort of raises the next question, doesn't it? Which is the how part. You know, how do we, whether it's civility or love, how do we love our political foes?
I think that we possess deep intelligence on what love actually is about, how it actually works in life, that we don't apply in public life. And so I think actually the answer to this question is more readily at hand than we imagine. You know, Martin Luther King Jr. was constantly criticized for talking about love. And he said, I am gonna keep talking about love. And he said, I'm not talking about emotional bosh. I love that, because that's mostly how that word is understood. I'm talking about a hard, demanding love. Mm-hmm. So if I think about what are the ingredients of love that might apply to our public life, I think, what are the ingredients of love as we live it? And we know so many things about love that fly in the face of how we're behaving with each other right now. Love is, so in our most intimate relationships, love is very often, perhaps most often, not about how we feel. It's about how we are present. It's about small routine actions. It's also not very often about feeling perfectly understood or perfectly understanding or agreeing with the other person. And it often means not talking about certain things right now. We apply emotional intelligence. And I think that a lack of emotional intelligence in our public life writ large, it is perhaps the most urgent thing that we have to rectify. And we have to rectify it, whatever is happening in the White House or in Congress or in our media of choice that we're mad at. I'm very mad at my media of choice right now. But we can start behaving like grown-ups and modeling that for our children in our neighborhoods, in our communities, in the civil society, on the ground on which we stand. As I watch that map of our country on election night, you know, the goal was to get to filling in every state with red or with blue. But what you saw as they pulled the camera out or in is that this is an illusion. There are no red states and blue states. Like, these lines of fracture run through all of our states. They run through our counties and they run through our families. So the other side that we turn into a caricature is much closer than we think, and much more contradictory, and perhaps just as maddening as before.
So in just the little time that we've got left, Krista, let's see if we can make a suggestion for everybody watching us on the one thing they should not do at the Thanksgiving table that they might have done otherwise that would make things worse, such that they can leave the Thanksgiving table and the Thanksgiving dinner with things better. So what's the one thing to not do?
Well, what do you think? I want to hear your answer.
Well, my answer actually, believe it or not, it actually comes from the brain science research on how people perceive each other. And, you know, we have a million ways to read the emotions of other people, and most of it is not verbal. And when we perceive that somebody's treating us with contempt, with disdain, that's basically somebody saying to us, I hate you because you are worthless and what you're saying is worthless. The number one way that we convey that to others unintentionally, okay, and this is what John Gottman, who's one of the greatest marriage therapists ever, he says he can tell if a couple is going to be divorced within 5 years with something like 97% accuracy. You know what he's looking for? Eye rolling. It's the love killer. Why? Because it says, that is the stupidest thing I've ever heard. And it's a habit. Now, look, I have young adult children. So they roll their eyes so hard, they're going to fall backwards in their chairs. But when somebody is your peer and owes you love and you say something that you really believe and they roll their eyes, that kills the discourse, that kills the communication, that cuts the bonds of potential love that we're trying to foster. And so my very practical suggestion, I mean, it's just as practical as it can be, is vow to yourself that no matter what you hear, you will not be sarcastic, you will not be derisive, you will not be dismissive. And most of all, this Thanksgiving, it will be a no eye rolling zone. And if you make that commitment, Thanksgiving will be better and we'll make progress.
Yeah, I like that. I can't prove this, but I think it's true that no human being in history has ever changed because someone told them they were stupid. And we all need to confront the question in ourselves of whether we want to keep being right or feeling like we're on the side of right, or whether we want things to change. And I don't think that's a partisan question. I don't think the vast majority of us, to me, the real silent majority, it's all of us on left of center, right of center, who don't want to pass on this way of being political to our children. I think the advice I have is pre-work to your no eye rolling. Ask questions that are really questions. Like, we are so skilled in this. Our questions are arguments.
Yeah.
We have preordained conclusions. And really being present, really creating that space for relationship, needs real curiosity. Like, when that conversation starts, are you really ready to be surprised?
Hmm.
And if you are, that becomes a great adventure.
Krista, what a delight it's been to be with you. I hope that you have a happy and love-filled Thanksgiving. And I hope that together we can do this together again, and that we can bring more ideas and we can bring them into our own lives and the lives of others. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Arthur. It's wonderful to be with you.
I covered the murder of a woman when I was writing for New York Newsday. And I remember reporting that story. It was really heartbreaking. And my editor calling me up at 5 a.m. the next morning to tell me what a great job I had done, because I'd gotten these really extraordinary details. And I actually just felt the opposite. I thought, yeah, maybe it was a good job reporting, but what had I really sent out into the world? And that story really tipped it for me. I thought, you know what? I really have to look for different kinds of stories to tell. How do you help people see the world through the lens of possibilities? What are the options available to people to build a better world, as opposed to what the news generally gives people, which is a sense of what you should be fearful of, what you should judge? I think in general, the news has been harmful in many ways to democracy. It has overwhelmingly told people stories about what's broken, about what you should be afraid of, about who you shouldn't trust. Solutions journalism is simply rigorous reporting that looks at how people are responding to problems and really what we can learn from it. If you're an editor of a newspaper and you've covered, let's say, the opioid crisis in your community, and you've done 20 stories about it, all about the pain and suffering, it begs the question, have you given your community a sense of what their options are to do better? there are other communities that are doing smarter things to prevent overdoses or to help people who have had addictions. And if you give people only one side of the picture, you're not actually activating people to be powerful members of a democracy. In some cases, you're making them feel powerless, and in other cases, you're making them feel hopeless. We've really been the leading organization advocating or advancing for solutions journalism to be integrated into the news in a more systematic way, because that's what people want to do. We're wired to try to fix things. I mean, our brains are adapted to solve problems. Journalism should feed that capacity. So I think that there's a huge opportunity to improve journalism and in so doing to strengthen democracy.
Hello, hello, it's Baratunde here with you again, and just want to reflect on some of what we just saw. What David Bornstein is up to with solutions journalism is right after my own heart, to shift the lens away from just the problems to those who are working on those problems. That's why I do my podcast, How to Citizen with Baratunde, which I probably should have told you about earlier, but I'm still in a crazed emotional state. Arthur and Krista really took us to some places, I think, of honesty about the type of love we're talking about, not that sentimental, emotional bosh, to quote King, and to ask questions of folks and not just show up with arguments. The states of being that you have shared have also connected. I want to acknowledge Kat in a state of denial. I like that one. Linda in North Carolina, also in a state of grace, which I think goes pretty well with North Carolina, especially because your barbecue down there is very graceful. Consuela from London, in a state of excitement and exhaustion. And it's not even our country, but we affect the whole world. Thank you, Consuela. We feel you too. Morgan reminds us on the Thanksgiving front, to be safe, let's do it via Zoom. And we're in a very difficult time in our nation, in the world, in fact, with COVID-19. So thank you for the reminder, Morgan. And finally, Bambi is in a state of Ohio and a state of cautious optimism, which I am sure captures many of us. Now we're going to take a look at how you responded to our first poll. Civility, is it finished? Is it unfinished? 93% of you say civility is unfinished. I think it's pretty obvious it's not finished. So good on you for seeing the same world that most of us see. To the 7%, if you think it's finished, do you think we've completed it? Or do you think it's unachievable, unattainable? I'm kind of curious about that. While we're thinking about civility and what we heard from Arthur and Krista, I'm curious about connecting across differences with strangers or even people in your community and family. Krista's advice to us is to ask questions that are really questions and not arguments. She says to be present and to stay curious. So with that in mind, what questions would you ask those who may have a different political point of view from your own? These are questions aimed at understanding rather than provoking. Please add those questions on your mind to the chat. And coming up, we've got artists Alfredo Jarr and Hank Willis Thomas talking about a partnership between Unfinished and the Arts Civic Organization Four Freedoms, where, speaking of questions, we invited artists to share their most urgent question and turn it into a billboard. There's currently a billboard with an artist's question in every state in our union. Then we'll get into some of the questions being asked on those billboards when we join Ashoka Fellowship recipient, author, and CEO of Citizen University, Eric Liu, along with world-renowned cellist, Grammy Award winner, and Presidential Medal of Freedom recipient, Yo-Yo Ma, for a conversation about the art of democracy. Let's dig in.
You moved to New York in 1982 from Chile, and you started off as an architect. But prior to that, you'd already been doing situational or public art in Chile. Can you talk about the billboard projects that you did there and what inspired them?
I was trying to make art in the middle of a dictatorship. You learn how to speak in between the lines in a poetic, cryptic, mysterious way so that the censors do not know how to read what you're saying. There was no democracy, and I wanted to offer a space of freedom, a space of resistance.
The piece that I first saw was a logo for America. Challenged my idea of what art is, where art can be, and what it should say in the public.
Public art is perhaps the most deep expression of democracy that exists. And I'm so impressed that you have created Full Freedoms because you have realized that this is what's happened. You are a studio artist, and suddenly you create this institution that is really inviting artists to express themselves in the public space.
Well, I studied photography at NYU. Only later did I start to really understand the other aspects of your practice, Logo for America, and as you said, Felice, they're the prototype, the original framework this whole billboard campaign is around.
You're creating little cracks in the system. Every single public space is controlled by governments or institutions. In fact, you actually have to purchase advertising spaces in order to raise your voices. Our challenge is, how do we create ideas, images, words that resist and do not drown in this sea of consumption?
With this current project where we're working with over 100 artists doing billboards in all 50 states, we've been given the opportunity to use a little bit of that space to sell ideas, questions, reshaping our notions of the world and where we belong and how we should value. Millions of people across the country will see these billboards.
For me, it's an honor to recreate this work from such a long time away from another world.
I hope that someday something that I have been a part of will be inspiring hundreds of artists to speak to millions of people at some point when they really need to. So it's really an honor to take part in this. Thank you so much.
I'm Eric Liu, and I'm here with Yo-Yo Ma, and I share that hope that Hank Willis Thomas just expressed, that we might be able, through our work and our art, to leave some kind of legacy that people will find useful and meaningful. Yo-Yo, you and I have been having a conversation over many years now about what it means to be a citizen artist in both directions, the artist as citizen, as you certainly are, and the citizen also as artist, thinking about how you move in the world as a certain kind of art form itself. And we're going to have a conversation that is going to be structured in part by questions that are posed on billboards from this unfinished Four Freedoms project, where billboards are being put up all around the United States and beyond. And I'm going to pose the first question to you so we can dive right in. This is a question from a very moving billboard that I actually saw, and it is this: how do you keep your heart open?
That's actually the job of a human being and of a musician. The heart is a muscle. And if you don't use a muscle, it atrophies. The brain, in a way, is also a muscle. And I think you can't just keep your heart open all the time. You do have to check in heart and brain together in equilibrium, so that you basically, you feel things, you intuit things, but you also analyze things. And if you do both back and forth, you have the greatest chance to keep your non-judgmental side active, which is some people call beginner's mind. A child is full of wonder because everything is new, is for the first time. And we treasure that as adults because, oh, it's so wonderful because a person who is, in a way, innocent from or free from judgment can actually see a different view and a different world that actually need, that we can compare to with the, you know, the analytical mind. But I'm curious how you came to this open heart, open mind citizenship idea. You know, what was it? Did it come through experience from studies? Because right now we're going through a lot of pain. And so what can we do with all this pain?
We've got to first let it flow. So much of what is dysfunctional in our politics right now is basically pain displaced, pain suppressed, pain unnamed, pain unseen, unrecognized. I think the first thing we've got to be able to do is actually create a sense of permission to name that pain. And what we can do with it then is actually direct it, give it a conduit. Once you've actually decided to name it, it's not then a matter of just putting it on the table and admiring it. We don't want to fall in love with our pain, but we want to find a conduit for it where it can be converted into power. And this is where the idea of citizen artistry comes in. Bring it down to the scale of you and strangers in the town you live in, and you walking past somebody who's hurting, you walking past somebody who's homeless, you encountering somebody who's dressed like they think differently, worship differently, believe differently from you. And the question is, am I going to make a micro choice right now to actually not pass my pain onto this person and judge them harshly, but actually imagine if I'm hurting, they're probably hurting too. And is there an opening I can make here for us to rehumanize each other? And, you know, I guess that brings me to the second billboard and question that comes to mind that I want to pose to you, which is simple and incredibly complex. And that is, in this time where we are so divided and so tribalized and polarized, can we coexist? Is that possible?
The first thing about coexistence is recognition of who the other person is. And to your comment about pain, I think it's as simple as you hurt, I hurt. Empathy. And if you recognize that I recognize you for what you think you are, or what you're going through, I would call that trust. And if we can actually build on trust that's built on empathy and being able to be vulnerable and safe with one another, if we can actually choose that what you seem to say is true for you, I don't deny it. I hear you. I may have a different truth, and those truths can actually exist and may even be stronger together. So in that sense, we're talking about our country, and you and I are ethnically Asian, Chinese ancestry. We haven't talked a huge amount about that, but we're both, I think, patriotic Americans, right? We believe in America, but we weren't here since the very beginning. So tell me, you know, I'm an immigrant. I think you were born in the States. So that's something slightly different, but who do you think gets to be American today? And what does that mean? What does that mean historically? Do you absorb all of what America has been? The land that it was before, you know, it was called America? What is your answer? How do you deal with that as a citizen, as a human?
So when you ask the question, who gets to be American? Well, my first answer is every last one of us. Every last one of us gets to claim America. And I think that that is the very seat of what I would describe as my patriotism. The idea that to be American is not to have the dumb luck to have been born here like I was. To be American is not to, you know, thump your chest and wave the flag and signal to others how patriotic you are. To be American is to say, wherever my ancestors and I were born, I claim this country. And I claim it not by saying it, but by contributing to it. I claim it by showing up. I claim it by creating and inviting and helping people make a new story of us. But I think there's been a long, long time, great percentage of this country's life, where Americanness and whiteness were fused together as one. And what we're living through right now, good, bad, ugly, is the decoupling of those two things. And the recognition that to be American is far more complicated than that. It always has been, to your point. Long before there were European colonists and settlers here, there was a land here. And we acknowledge that land. We acknowledge the first people who walked that land here. And what it means to be American is not only to claim those creedal ideas, but it also means to commit in a spirit of the artist, to always making new hybrids. America is, one thing America is not, is America is not about purity. It is not about pure bloodline, pure territory, pure, you know, history, as much as we like to have genealogical study. America is about how we've been mixing blood, ideas, food, you know, DNA, everything from the get-go, and embracing that hybridity and recognizing that with that embrace and with that recreation, we make things here that the world cannot yet imagine.
I think one of the things that's very difficult for all people of all nations, but in the United States is, and as an immigrant or as newer arrived Americans, are we responsible for a past that we were not part of? And are we responsible for, in a way, when are we responsible for the actions of others? Can we move forward without confronting our past?
You know, I think it is absolute. I think the only way to move forward as a society is to confront that common collective past in its full glory and sordidness. There is a fuller story here. And that to tell the fuller story is not to negate either part of it, but it is to recognize that actually as Americans, it turns out we're human. It turns out we have both better angels and inner demons. And it turns out we are capable at different times and we are capable at the same time of expressing them. And so if we're ever going to move forward together as a hybrid nation, as a country that is in fact trying to do something rather audacious in human history, and that is to be planet Earth's first mass, multiracial, multi-faith democratic republic. Ain't been done before, right? We're trying it. And the only way that's going to work is if we actually face ourselves and our history honestly, not as a cudgel, but as a, in the same way that you were saying from the beginning, a way of holding beginner's mind, beginner's heart, taking responsibility. I didn't enslave anybody and neither did you. And yet we are the beneficiaries, both of us, of so many different parts of our society and institution that were built upon discrimination. And so you can't take the good without owning the bad and what it means to be not just an American, what it means to be a grown-up.
I completely agree with what you're saying, that the best of what we can be is to be really honest with one another about everything. One thing that I love about something that we do very naturally to people we see on the street, airports, who are in the military, we go to them and we say, thank you for your service, right? We don't know what they're doing in the military, and we don't, I know that, and it doesn't matter whether you agree with the policies of whatever, we thank them for what you know that they are willing to put themselves through. Or we thank anybody who has gone through hard times. We go to people who we know whose towns have been devastated because, you know, industries pulled out, but they're proud of what they've done, of what they, of this is their country. And somehow, we just want to acknowledge what they have contributed to everybody's welfare. And I think there's a universal wish for every human being that we want two things. We want to be special and we want to belong. And if we can live with the contradictions and acknowledge that they exist and realize that we are living the American experiment, our nation was invented. It is a creative, evolutionary thing. We call this the American experiment. Our coins say pluribus unum, which is out of many, one. That's embedded in our national DNA. And so you know, in that sense, we can go back to basics. We can go back to our originalism and say, yeah, let's live that. Let's make it one. And then we can move forward.
And in making it one, it's the one, you know, in the Whitman sense of, I contain multitudes. One contains the whole, and the whole of who we are can't be expressed, can't even be uncovered in ourselves until and unless we're willing to do those things you've described, to face pain, to reckon with our history, to name facts of who's been on the short end of the stick in terms of how power has been structured and allocated by race and gender and national origin in this country's life. And then as we do that, to recognize still, as you said, that we're trying to make this thing work together. And I love what you said earlier, Yo-Yo, and I will close with this line. Thank you for your service.
And yours. It's great to see you.
It's great to see you, my friend. It's great to be with you.
Really.
Hello, hello, and what a powerful, honest, wise conversation that was. Yo-Yo Ma and Eric Liu keeping it real about the history and claiming all of it, not just the good parts, and reminding us of the humanness of the endeavor. And Eric with the whole, like, we haven't done this before, this mass multiracial democratic republic. I've been going through on my screen to see, we have over 1,000 messages from you so far, just FYI. That's a lot of scrolling. And you have come up with some beautiful questions to ask people with whom you disagree. Here are a few. Esther says, hello, Esther. Dyson, would you like to share a meal? That's an open, that's a big question, because then you gotta follow through with the meal. You know what I'm saying? Like, it's not just rhetoric at that point. Somebody's cooking. Christine says, tell me about your grandparents, that just shifts the whole conversation, generationally shifts it. Karen says, what keeps you up at night? And Justine asks, what do you want for your kids? Gwen offered up this, what is your greatest fear and your greatest hope? Thank you for engaging in this. Keep adding to it, screenshot it, and then use it. There are many of us who need these conversations to happen. And if you're in a position to have them, these are some very helpful tools to get them going lovingly and curiously. Next, we're gonna try something different. As I said, this election had the highest voter turnout in modern history. Through hurricanes and fires and attempts to make voting harder, which no true believer in democracy should ever do, and of course the pandemic, to see people show up and show out for democracy is really great. And for some folks, this was the first election they ever voted in. Can you imagine jumping into the deep end of the democracy pool in this election? Like, welcome to the club. I'm sorry, it's crazy in here. We spoke with a group of first-time voters across the U.S. the day after the election to find out what made them participate, what their experiences were like, and where they see things going now. This piece is brought to us by Georgetown University's Institute of Politics and Public Service and pollster Kristen Soltis Anderson, author of The Selfie Vote. Let's take a look.
Each of you is here because you said that this election, you voted for the very first time. And so I want to hear from each of you, what was running through your head and your heart in that moment?
During the voting, I was just kind of anxious to get it over with and get my voting done and counted.
Putting it in the envelope and putting it in the mailbox, it was really exciting, and it made me really excited for the future. And it made me feel important. Even though it's just one vote, it all matters in the grand scheme of things.
Well, I was really excited because it was my first time. So actually going there and everything, I thought it was going to be like a fun experience.
I thought the process of voting was going to be like complicated and like choosing who you want and who you don't. But after the whole process, I felt pretty calm and pretty, responsible with my decision.
Filling it out and casting it, leaving, I was just like, okay, I did my part.
that was it. It's kind of just something you do.
I was a little bit cynical because I didn't really know if it would matter or if it was kind of for a show, if that makes sense.
So I felt like pretty excited that I was doing it and then like slightly worried that if like everything was like filled out correctly.
Did you go in knowing how you wanted to vote on everything that was on that ballot, or were there some things where you were making up your mind in that moment?
So I did a little bit of research, but I also just stuck with my party and voted consistent.
I looked up my ballot before I'd gone in, so I generally knew exactly what I was voting for and who I was voting for. I had a couple issues that were more important to me than others, so I really focused on those.
I really only knew for sure where I was going to go for the presidential vote.
When actually I was like filling out the vote, I felt like kind of lost because I saw a lot of names I didn't even like know about.
What would have made it easier for you to feel like an informed voter on everything that was on that ballot?
I think it definitely would have been easier if I could just have the facts and then make my own decision rather than listening to somebody else make their decision for me.
Did you ever get contacted by anybody?
I actually got a text message from one of the parties, and it was kind of distasteful. Not the message itself, but the act of sending me a message trying to persuade me into doing something I didn't really approve of. And I also got a lot of mail.
I actually did work on a campaign as an intern doing like the social media stuff. And last week they made us like call people doing phone banks.
Did you enjoy the experience of doing that phone banking, of calling people and talking to them?
Not really, because I mean, it was like, like 50 calls. I would get like 3 of them answered and like they would like hang up or be like rude.
Well, I want to step back now and think about our democratic system as a whole and ask a pretty big question, which is, do you think your vote mattered?
I would like to believe so personally, but I can only do my part.
I think it does. I think it's just in the act of it itself, maybe not the vote. That's important, just showing that like younger people are voting.
I heavily do not agree with the winner take all electoral college system. I think that's totally broken and needs to be reformed, because in that sense, no, my vote did not count. The candidate got nothing from me.
Amelia, how about you? Do you feel like your vote counted?
I do, because I think that'll help motivate me to vote in the future as well. I think it's kind of easy to think it doesn't, because in the grand scheme of things, one vote, if I didn't vote, it wouldn't really make a difference. But I think if everyone had that mindset, then it would make a difference. So I definitely do think it counts.
My state is definitely the furthest thing from a swing state. And I don't necessarily agree with everybody else. So in that sense, it kind of sucks that my vote didn't go towards the Electoral College vote. But I do really think it's important to get my voice heard in the popular vote.
Do you think the fact that you voted means that the people who are in office are more likely to listen to someone like you or folks in your generation?
If you're not going to vote, then there is no voice to be heard. So I feel like voting, definitely, even if it is just a small percentage, it definitely helps get your voice and your opinion out there and helps select people that matter to you.
Do you think that democracy is working for your generation?
I think there is definitely issues there. As mentioned before, like the Electoral College, I think it's a very outdated notion.
The voting system is kind of outdated. If it were for me, I would like more if it was more like the popular vote.
But I also feel like people my age have had so little exposure to politics and government that sometimes they feel discouraged.
Any things that you would change about our elections system and how we elect our leaders in this country? What would you change if you could change anything?
First off, in education, I would set like a priority that you need to learn about your government and how it runs and how to be an informed citizen, because I think that's most important out of anything.
I feel like it should be claimed a national holiday and that everyone should get off of work.
Are there any, you know, people, groups, institutions that you think you might not trust as much when it comes to democracy, or who are maybe making it harder for the system to work the way it's supposed to?
I think the number one issue is media bias. You can go on one news channel, they're telling you something, and then you flip to an opposing news channel and they're literally telling you the exact opposite.
You've got to really like do your work to find a media source that you feel like is
Yeah, it's
right down
tough.
The middle and trustworthy.
It's mm-hmm. difficult because, like, our nation is very polarized, and it doesn't help that you go into separate echo chambers and get all riled up. People are questioning whether they want to be friends with me or not based off of my political opinions, which I think is pretty dangerous to do.
Are there any of you who do think, yeah, maybe I can see myself running for office one day?
Sometimes I like have the passing thought like, oh, maybe I should do this. So I might just stick to being more like an active member of society rather than running for office.
I definitely see myself running for office. I mean, presidential would be nice. Obviously, I have a long ways from there.
I'm so glad that you all decided to participate in the process. Congratulations on doing that. It's a really big deal. And thank you all again for participating.
I was standing in the kitchen when it occurred to me that I didn't have it on me. I thought that I did, but I didn't, and I couldn't remember where I'd placed it or when was the last time I'd seen it or saw it. And so I decided to retrace my steps. I searched the house first, the living room, the dining room. I searched the kitchen cabinets and cupboards. I searched the bedroom. I looked under the bed, the pillows, and between the sheets. And then I searched the attic. I searched in old trunks, throwing out all the old clothes, digging deep. But it wasn't there. I searched the storage room and my office, searching around my computer where I often sit, looking, hoping, praying that I'd find it there. I searched my dresser drawer, my panty drawer, my jewelry box where I keep my keepsakes, but it wasn't there. I searched the face of my husband and that of my mother and my daughter, along with the faces of children, and I still couldn't find it. Frantic, I called my friends, asking if maybe I had left it with them. Had they seen it? They all said no. I would keep an eye out. I searched high and low. I searched for days and days and days and days. Troubled, I searched Wikipedia, Webster, and the dark web. I searched the Constitution, newspapers, podcasts, journals, and op-ed pieces. I called congressmen and women, senators and state representatives, but they had no idea. I searched the White House and the Republic on which it stands, from sea to shining sea, from the Pacific to the Atlantic, and everything in between, high and low. I searched the halls of justice and along the long lines of voters waiting to cast their ballot, but then I thought I was in another country. I searched the rich, the powerful, and the privileged. And I searched amongst the poor and the disenfranchised. And then I thought, well, it's missing. Puzzled, I began to imagine that it had all been simply a dream. That I had never had it, I only thought that I did. Democracy. What is it? Is it real or an illusion? Is it a work in progress, an idea to aspire to or to dream of, an impossible goal never to be reached? And then I remembered I had gone to several protest demonstrations and thought perhaps I'd left it there.
What you just saw is a film from Carrie Mae Weems, brought to us by the Cultural Arts Center known as The Shed. Carrie is an extraordinary artist who explores many of the themes we've surfaced today, like how democracy, by definition, is participatory. And I just love that we're looking at the art of democracy in tonight's show. Sometimes these things get couched as curriculum and technical and mathematical and stacks of white papers. And there's so many other ways to access the soul of a nation and the spirit of a people. And art is one of those rich ways. So thank you to Carrie Mae Weems for that. I want to get you involved in the conversation and hear what you had to say. Before I get to the Electoral College poll, though, I got to call out some beautiful comments that I've seen in between. Eric Liu is a national treasure, says Elizabeth Franklin. I totally agree with you. We should wrap him up in bubble wrap and keep him safe for all time. Phyllis Caldwell says, as a 60-something, listening to these first-time voters reverses any episodes of pessimism. We're in good hands. That's why we put them there. Oh, yes, yes, yes. And Kayla M. writes, the brokenness of our country's past is not our fault, but our healing is our collective responsibility. Really powerful words, Kayla. Thank you for that. Now let's see what you had to say in response to our second poll about the Electoral College. Is it finished or unfinished? And the numbers are in, and 68% of you say it is finished. That is a veto-proof majority in the Senate of you. I'm with you. I would love to just count this as a constitutional convention right now, and let's do away with the slave era framework for diluting power. But I'm not in charge. We've got to do this together. With such polarization, I've been seeking wisdom and insights about where we go from here. We're such a divided nation right now. And I wanted to hear from some voices who think deeply about civics, faith, and how we actually make progress. So I am super honored slash stoked slash lit slash everything good to bring us the Reverend William Barber, a minister and activist who serves as president of Repairers of the Breach, co-chair of the Poor People's Campaign, and a member of the National Board of the NAACP. Interviewing Reverend Barber is Now This News senior correspondent, Varsha Sharma. We'll get into that conversation right after this.
With all that's going on in America, when can the healing begin? Good question.
I don't think the question is when healing is going to begin. I think it's if healing is going to begin.
I think the healing can begin in America when everyone takes a look at themselves and see what they want the change to be.
I believe that healing can begin anytime if healing is something that people want to do.
The divisions, even within my own family, were just so deep. How has that multiplied across the country?
In these recent times, it seems like the people's voices are really being suppressed.
America will not remain America if this continues.
But we also need a participatory democracy, making sure that our communities are just and using our voices on a local level.
Healing, put people back to work.
With any sort of healing process, the healing is going to be slow.
Probably not before I'm 6 feet under.
It's been such a long time. It's been hundreds of years, and it's still inequality in the world.
Democracy in its current state, it don't work.
People are quite tired of the daily divisive talk. Get exhausted.
I feel like we forget that we're all on the same team.
We have so much more in common. Like, if you look at nature, healing is cyclical. There will be a death, but there can be a rebirth.
In American history, there have been periods of time when we've been profoundly divided. And I think one of the things that's special and beautiful about America is the ability to reinvent itself, to regenerate and become something new and better that is closer to its founding ideals and that fixes a lot of the problems that existed in the previous era.
I believe there can be some revolution.
You have to fix what you can.
You should cry more when you need to cry, and don't hold back your emotions.
What's wrong? How can we avoid this from ever happening again?
Democracy takes work. It takes heart. It takes a tremendous amount of patience.
You have to fight from here.
Reverend Barber, thank you so much for joining us. I really appreciate it. You're probably honestly one of the top people that I and others want to hear from in the country right now. In his first speech as president-elect, Joe Biden talked about healing for our nation. He ran on that as a big part of his campaign. And I would just like to hear from you what you think actively that looks like right now. What do people need to do?
Well, thank you so much for having me. And, you know, in the Poor People's Campaign, the National Call for Moral Revival, we contacted over 2.3 million poor and low-wealth infrequent voters. And a lot of them turned out after we contacted them. And why did they turn out is because they weren't voting for normal. They were voting for their lives. So when we say healing, we have to ask, well, what's sick, right? What's sick? Now, we can't say division is the ultimate sickness because the country is always going to be divided. It's a two-party country. We've had that for years. But what we know is what's sick. We're in the middle of a pandemic. We got 140 million plus people poor and low wealth. So that's what needs to be healed. So we have to address poverty. We know that we have 100 million people or more without health insurance in the middle of a pandemic, without health insurance or underinsured. That's what's sick. So we have to expand healthcare. We know that people are facing or working, essential workers, without health, without sick leave, without guaranteed sick leave and unemployment. They're afraid of evictions. These are the things that are sick. And interestingly enough, finally, 62 million people in this country want a minimum wage raise. 60% of people. 60% of people want to expand healthcare. That's where the country is. So I say that the healing is in the mandate that comes from the mourning, M-O-U-R-N-I-N-G. Where people are mourning, that's the mandate of the policies we need. The pain ought to dictate the policies. And that's when you heal people. You heal the soul of the nation by healing the body of the people.
I agree with you that on some level, we're always going to be a divided country for the reasons that you mentioned. And former President Obama, when he was congratulating Biden, he said on every level, the elections show that there is some deep, even bitter division in this country between supporters of the two candidates, supporters of the two parties. So to that question, what do you think Biden and other leaders can do right now to try to bridge that gap?
I think, first of all, don't live in the mythology that there's some place behind us where it wasn't bitter. Don't put all of this on Trump. Trump didn't create all of this. And we're getting ready to find out when he's no longer in the White House that he didn't create all of this. He exploited what was already created. And if we create the mythology that what we see now is one person, then we never get at the issue. People are hurting. I've been all up in Appalachia, all places in the Poor People's Campaign that we were told we couldn't go, Kentucky, Appalachia, places they claim a Trump country. I find that a lot of people aren't anybody's country. They just feel abandoned. They feel like nobody cares about them. And they really, it's amazing how many of them just wish the country would care. If Biden and Harris put an agenda, or even on McConnell's desk, that addresses and begins to deal with poverty and lack of health care and living wages, and put it on his desk like it should be. Don't deal with it in the back room, in the front room. Then lobby for it and put faces on it and show people that would be made better. Show that they are Republican and Democrat, they are Black and they're white and they're brown, they're Asian and they're indigenous. Then give the people a chance to move and to push. We can really change some policies, but we can't do it if we already start out saying that's quote unquote socialism. It is not socialism. That we have a mandate. The mandate comes from the Constitution and Declaration of Independence. Pursuit of happiness is the mandate. Promoting general welfare is the mandate. Equal protection under the law is the mandate. Just do what we said is in writing. That's the way you heal the nation. Don't come up with something else. Do what we said we would do in writing. Become established justice.
Now, Reverend, as a final question, at this moment of transition, if we were to offer up a prayer for our democracy right now, what would that sound like?
For this moment, my prayer is simply the prayer of Jesus. And that is the prayer that we recognize every nation will ultimately be judged by how it treats the least of these, the poor, the hurting, the hungry, the homeless, the immigrant, the sick, and those who are on the margins of society. 62 million people that vote or are eligible to vote are poor and low wealth. that the poor and low wealth people are 30% of the electorate and 43% and growing of this country. You cannot leave nearly 50% of a country unaddressed, untalked about, and their issues undealt with. But if you deal with those issues, then we can become truly one nation under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. But it's going to come through poor and low wealth people and lifting the rejected of this country. My prayer is that we don't stay stuck in these puny arguments, but we talk about what's right and what's wrong. And we talk about loving people and caring more about people than we care about corporations. We don't treat corporations like people and people like things. Instead, we see all of us as creatures and creations of God, and we lift from the bottom. We lift from the bottom. My prayer is that we lift from the bottom, and in that way, we transform the nation.
Reverend, thank you so much for your time. Your work is inspiring, and we all thank you for it.
Thank you so much, and God bless you.
Hi, my name is Nyama Sophia Sandy. I'm a member of the Resistance Revival Chorus. The Resistance Revival Chorus was founded in 2017. We are a group of 60 plus women and non-binary artists and activists who join together to breathe joy and love into the resistance. We're offering you a song called This Little Light of Mine, which of course is one of these songs that many of us learned as children. But thinking about a single solitary light as just so powerful and impactful for so many people, we hope that you will think about that in your life, in your work, whatever it may be, and how your light can shine and impact others in your community toward change for the better. Thank you and enjoy the show.
This little light of mine, I'm gonna let it shine. This little light of mine, I'm gonna let it shine. This little light of mine, I'm gonna let it shine. Let it shine, let it shine, let it shine. Deep down in my heart, I'm gonna let it shine. Deep down in my heart, I'm gonna let it shine. Deep down in my heart, I'm gonna let it shine. Let it shine, let it shine, let it shine. All around the
This little light of mine, I'm gonna let it shine. Oh, I love that. And honestly, we have been subjected to many a Zoom choral performance over the past several months, but the Resistance Revival Chorus brought something new. The graphics, the sign language, the color palette. I'm here for it. It was all great. And speaking of great, Reverend William Barber, I need you to put your hands together wherever you are right now for this person who is channeling what we should be, what we said we could be, into being. Talk about keeping it real. This is what we're doing here at Unfinished Live. Pulling no punches. Reverend Barber said, you got to take care of the least of these. And he is so correct in that. And this division that we've been spending so much time talking about is not entirely new to this nation. We've always been a house divided to some degree or other. As we bring things to a close, I want to thank all of our incredible guests, our featured thinkers, our artists, our innovators. I want to thank you at home or wherever you are. If you're in your car right now, but not operating it, if you're in the office, but safely distanced, wherever you are, thank you for joining us, for being a part of this conversation about our democracy and our voice. I want to thank the crew here in Los Angeles. I want to thank the workers everywhere who've made this possible. I want to thank Cloud Services for giving us a distributed internet on which to do this and still stay connected in such disconnected times. What did we learn today? Where are we? What's possible now? Healing requires an acknowledgement of pain. There's one thing you remember from that tonight. Let that be it. We must acknowledge each other's pain. And to whatever degree you are suffering, remember you're not alone in that. There's some solidarity in that, some shared humanity in that. So let's share that and share that healing process together. We're not done yet. We've got a lot more work to do in democracy, of course, but also in Unfinished Live, because there's two more episodes, with the next one set to drop in 2 weeks on November 24th. On that date, we will be talking about technology and humanity with voices like Tristan Harris, Manush Zomorodi, and Meredith Whitaker. This is perfect timing. A lot of us are going to be doing things like Thanksgiving over Zoom. Remember that comment from earlier tonight? Using technology to get closer to the people we care about. But we should ask, is that the right role for technology when we're not corralled into it by a global pandemic? Is this technology making us more connected to our humanity or just to services, devices, and a departure of our money? I've been thinking about this question for a very long time, and I'm excited to take part in that conversation with you. November 24th, 2 weeks from now. And remember, it's a conversation, so drop your questions at unfinished.com and in our chat right now. We will get to as many of them as possible during our next episode. Please also respond to our survey and let us know how we're doing and what you'd like to see more or less of. Bring your friends next time. Bring your opponents next time. Get everybody involved. Thank you for being a part of this, and I will see you in 2 weeks. In the meantime, all the time, be good to each other.